Alabama and six other states recently filed a lawsuit to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also known as DACA. The Obama-era program protects about 700,000 young immigrants from deportation, roughly 24,000 of these so-called dreamers in the state of Georgia. Valentina Emilia Garcia-Gonzalez is among them, and she's been on Second Thought in the past and joins us again. So welcome back, Valentina.
Thank you for having me again.
So the last time you came on the show, you were waiting for your DACA renewal. Do you have an update?
I do. So I thankfully received my DACA renewal, and I'm very happy to say that it's been extended for another 2 years. So that's another weight lifted off my shoulders.
For our listeners who might be meeting you for the first time, take us back and tell us a little bit about your arrival in the U.S. First, how old were you?
So I was 6 years old when I immigrated from Uruguay, and I came straight to Georgia, and I've lived in Georgia ever since. Our family that migrated was just me, my mom, and my younger brother. And we met up with my father, who had been here May of 2002, and we came here September of 2002. And we have lived in Gwinnett County ever since.
So what was it like living in Gwinnett County for you?
It was nice. I think that being around, since Gwinnett is like a very diverse county with a very good amount of Latinx people, it felt welcoming, and, you know, it wasn't that hard of a transition. We briefly moved to Kennesaw about a year or two ago, and we could feel like the change, where it was not the same as Gwinnett. Cobb County also has heavy police presence. So for us, it was a really hard transition to go from Gwinnett, where we had established this schedule, I guess I would say, of when to be outside, at what time, who was driving the car. And when we were in Cobb County, it was completely different. It was a constant, just anxiety-ridden day of, like, when my dad would go out, like, constant updates. He downloaded this app called Zillow, which is amazing, and he would report, like, literally road by road, street by street, where he was. And my mom, every single day to this day, follows him to make sure that he's okay and that he gets to work without being stopped by the police.
What does he do for work?
So my dad does this, like, cable thing. Like, he sets up security cameras and, like, electric wiring in buildings that are being built.
That's pretty stressful sounding. How about for you, who were one of those people covered in the DACA program? What did it feel like for you to wait for that authorization to stay?
It was hard because I think for a while I thought it was very superficial for me to worry so much about it, even though, like, I was already covered. It's just knowing that my time was coming up, right? And knowing that, you know, DACA is done. It was like people don't want it. And so it was, information was being thrown everywhere. Like, don't renew, don't file a renewal because it won't get, like, you're going to be wasting your money. Or do file your renewal because a judge stopped it. So you can definitely do a renewal. At the time when, so this winter term, so for Dartmouth, we have a quarter system. I was home from Thanksgiving up until March. I was in Georgia, and I was working, I was interning at Cook Baxter Immigration, and we had every single day, like, we were reading the news. Every month we had, like, a briefing, and in the first month that I was there, the attorneys were like, if you have DACA, renew it right now. And I did. So I took the leap, and my wallet cried a little bit, but we paid the fees for my brother, and thankfully the company paid my fees for my DACA renewal. And I filed, and I filed my brother's myself, and it was just a waiting game at that point, right? We were looking at the news every day, and we were just wondering, like, did we just waste our money? Will this be worse? Like, will this, like, these new renewals, would these be on file as people who are still in the country and wanting to renew? Like, would I be one of those people that is sought after by ICE, especially after news were coming out that ICE was apprehending and deporting DACA recipients too at this point? It was just really hard. But I thought for a while it was very superficial because my biggest concern was my graduation next year. So I graduate from Dartmouth College next year in 2019 in June. And before my DACA renewal got approved, my DACA was going to expire this year in September. And I was constantly worried about, well, who's going to drive up my parents for my graduation, right? Who, like, what am I going to do for them to see the fruits of their labor? Because my parents immigrated to this country for a better future for myself and my brother. And here I am, the first of my family to graduate high school and to go to college, and not just any college, like a prestigious Ivy League. And I'm finishing, like I'm about to graduate, and they can't even see that, right? And so that was what was on my mind a lot, is I really wanted DACA, one, to work and to help my family out from here. So I have about three to four jobs every term at Dartmouth, and I help my family out. And it's like, if I can't work, then how will like my family keep going? It's things like that, right, that people don't really think about. But thankfully, I got it renewed. And since I renewed early, it's not a complete 2 years from September. Like, I think I lost about 5 months. So it's only like a year and 7 months of renewal. But hey, it's something.
Right. And last time you were on Second Thought, you said that one of your fellow students had threatened to call ICE. Did that ever happen, or was that just a threat?
It was just a threat, thankfully. I think that was my freshman year, and it was hard. I think the political climate at that time, it was something that I didn't expect. I thought coming to Dartmouth, it was going to be very liberal, and everyone was like very like forward. You know, I saw like gender inclusive restrooms that just like don't exist in Georgia. So I was like, wow, like this is so progressive, this is so liberal, it's going to be great. And that's not the case, you know, and I learned really quickly that's not the case.
Has that happened since from any other students?
Once Trump got elected, there was an incident that I was a part of, and the house that I lived in was a part of, where there were students driving by in a car shouting pro-Trump, anti-immigrant things. They stopped in front of my house, which at the time that I was living is called La Casa. So it's the house, and it's under the Spanish and Portuguese department. And it was a very targeted attack, right? And it was really hard. Thankfully, I wasn't in the house at the time that it happened, but it was very scary to know that I could be walking around campus, at that time at least, and there are students that feel this way and that will act this way, right? So I would walk around campus just very anxious all the time, and I was just very scared that someone would say something to me or someone would hurt me physically. I had previously talked to like the media specialist or in the Office of Communications at Dartmouth. And this woman had said, after I started getting a lot more attention from the media of being like an out undocumented student at Dartmouth and in New Hampshire, she told me that, you know, you have to be careful what you say, because this is an open campus. Someone can recognize you across the street and they can be carrying a gun and they can hurt you. And I don't think she meant to necessarily scare me or try to stop me from what I was saying or like my message, but it's something that I carry with me every single day. And every time I do speak publicly about my status. So a couple weeks ago, I gave a TEDx talk here at Dartmouth, and I talked about, you know, being undocumented and contextualizing illegality and the whole anti-immigrant rhetoric here in the United States. And I talked to people and I was just like, I don't think you realize the fact that I'm risking my life talking about this, because this TEDx talk, yes, is happening at Dartmouth and people are going to come to it, but it's going to be global. So people are going to know my name. They're going to know what I look like. They're going to know that I am undocumented, and they can very easily find me in the side of the road or come up to me. You know, it's very real. And it's something that I carry with me every time I walk outside of my room and I go get food or I go to work. It's something that I'm very hypervigilant about. And it wears on you. I think that being here at Dartmouth, being around a majority of white people, whereas in Gwinnett, that's not the case, it's worn heavily on me, how I move about space, what I say, who I'm with. And it's just very draining emotionally and mentally.
I'm speaking with Valentina Emilia Garcia-Gonzalez. She is a young dreamer who grew up mostly in Georgia. She's now a student at Dartmouth College. Well, in addition to that felt anxiety, you told our producer about a trauma that you experienced at Dartmouth. Are you able to talk about what happened?
Yeah. So I, last year, during the summer, I was raped in my dorm room by a fellow student, someone who was my friend. And I was really taken aback by it. And I didn't know what to do because when I was younger, when I was 15 in Georgia, I was raped the first time of my life. Like, my virginity was taken, and I don't think it was taken. You know, I lost that. And when I went to press charges the first time when I was 15, the police officer that I was reporting to blamed me for my own assault and was like, well, you're undocumented, so if we press forward, like, I have to have your information, and you don't have much information for me to go off of, so this is a risk for you and your family, right? And so when this happened last year, I kept replaying that. I kept thinking, like, if I report this, if I press charges against this person, will I be retaliated against? And this is going off of the history of, like, my first year at Dartmouth, even me just proposing to run for student body president or student council. I was threatened by another student to have immigration called on me. So I was scared of, like, if I press charges against this individual, would they call immigration on me and to retaliate? Or would his friends, or would people that align with him or his friends, or I don't know, would they call immigration on me? So what I ended up doing instead was I gave a report to the Grafton County Police, and I gave a report to Title IX at Dartmouth. And I decided not to press charges because I was really afraid of retaliation. I was really afraid of nothing coming about it either. You know, we talk a lot about sexual assault here at Dartmouth and just, you know, in general. The thing is that it feels like sometimes nothing comes about it. And I feel like if I had pressed charges against him and he didn't go to jail or he didn't have the appropriate consequences, I feel like my trauma would not have been enough or valid enough to warrant, you know, action. So instead, I focused on going to counseling and trying to be as mentally okay about what happened as possible. But I think, you know, it's almost a year that this happened. Like, I still have very bad PTSD flashbacks about it. And I think it's hard to, as an immigrant, especially as an undocumented immigrant in the United States, to feel safe in this trauma and this assault kind of, like, exacerbated that. When I already don't feel safe walking around campus because I'm scared that someone's going to recognize me and, you know that I'm undocumented and do something to me. And now at night, I'm scared, you know, walking back from the library or to my dorm of, like, being assaulted again.
That's Valentina Gonzalez. She's a young dreamer who grew up in Gwinnett County. She now attends Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. We just heard about the mental health challenges facing Valentina as an immigrant. Just ahead, more of my conversation with her and what it takes to address some of those problems. This is On Second Thought from GPB News. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. And this hour, we're talking about the immigrant experience. Just before the break, I was speaking with Valentina Gonzalez. She is a young dreamer who lives in Georgia. She's now attending college in New Hampshire. There are a lot of people who would say, well, you shouldn't be in this country. I mean, what do you say to those who would question, first of all, the DACA program, or to say that this is a consequence of being here illegally?
The concept of illegality is very embedded into the American history. The concept of illegality and who we deem as illegal and who we deem as belonging and not belonging is very interesting to think about, because I haven't had many people come up to me and say things like you shouldn't be in this country because of the way I look. I'm very white passing. I can speak English very well. Like, I'm at a prestigious Ivy League. If anything, people would say, well, she deserves to be here. Out of all these immigrants, she can be here. She can stay, right? And I think it's a very toxic message, especially with the whole dreamer rhetoric, right? Of who is more deserving of being in this country and who is not. And that, again, aligns to specific images and specific goals that the American history and American public wants. But when it comes to, like, I shouldn't be here, I think people really need to look at the history of these countries that people are immigrating from, like Central America, South America, the Caribbean, other countries, of course. These people are fleeing their own countries for a specific reason. And they're seeking solace. They're seeking a safe haven because they can't find that at home. No one would uproot themselves and their family and leave absolutely everything behind if it wasn't absolutely necessary, right? And for someone to say you shouldn't be here, you shouldn't even exist in this country, is a fault of empathy and sympathy more than anything else. And that has been exacerbated by immigration policies and institutions here in the United States. And I think that's something that I as an individual can talk at length about, but it's an institutional thing. It's a power dynamic that goes beyond myself as an individual. And it is exacerbated by the policies, is exacerbated by people in power, in political power, that kind of dominate and help allow people to think a certain way, right? Like the whole fake news propaganda of how specific stories are spun to demonize and to criminalize immigrants. That's what it comes from. Like, that's where it comes from. That's where this anti-immigrant sentiment comes from. It's hard. It's hard for me as a 22-year-old individual to try to stir empathy and sympathy from someone who does not get it, right? I can talk at length about my experiences in this country. I could try to explain how it feels. I could try to explain why my parents came here and why they felt the need to completely uproot themselves. But at the end of the day, if you're not capable of empathy and sympathy, you won't get it, right? People are fleeing for a reason, and it's a very good reason. And if, you know, if America didn't boast very blindly about how great it was, quote unquote, then people wouldn't be coming here. But since immigrating, my family has conditioned me and my brother to be afraid and be cautious all the time. And I don't resent them. I don't resent my parents for that at all. I think it's just a collateral kind of consequence that comes with being an undocumented immigrant is like the anxiety and the fear that comes along with it, especially in a state like Georgia that's very anti-immigrant.
Well, Valentina, you said you grew up with the anxiety inherited, I think, by your parents. And on top of that, you've had this recent and regrettable, terrible trauma. You said you're doing counseling now. Briefly, can you tell me, how do you feel that's working?
I think I'm very privileged to be able to go to counseling because prior to coming to Dartmouth, I didn't have health insurance like many undocumented people here. And so I could not have this resource of therapy, of counseling. So I think a lot about if I wasn't at Dartmouth and this happened to me, like, how would I be dealing with this? Like, would I be dead? You know, like, would I have gotten so overwhelmed with all this trauma and all these emotions that I would have killed myself? And I think it's pervasive, especially in undocumented immigrant communities where we don't have access to healthcare. We don't have access to these mental health resources. So our mental health suffers greatly. And so I think that, you know, thankfully I have the privilege of being at Dartmouth and I have the privilege of having counseling and going through therapy and trying medication out for my diagnoses. I think it's going well. I think that I have, you know, not every day is a good day, but I have the resources that can help me be better and get the tools that I need to go about space and go about the rest of my life as fulfilling and as holy as I can.
Valentina, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
For sure. Thank you so much.
That's Valentina Gonzalez. She's a young dreamer who grew up in Gwinnett County. She attends Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. We're talking today about the mental health effects of the immigrant experience, and particularly the emotional stressors of undocumented immigrants. Belisa Urbina is executive director of Ser Familia. That's an organization that provides counseling for Hispanic and Latino immigrants in the metro Atlanta area. And Belisa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So tell us about some of the people who seek help from your organization.
We serve both young people and adults and families. They might be documented or undocumented. We're able to provide our services free of charge. So mostly the families we serve tend to be low-income families, and they're dealing with circumstances that are affecting their quality of life or the quality of the family relationships.
So what are some of those circumstances?
Usually, we see, especially among young people, we see a lot of depression and anxiety, and we, sadly, in the Latino community, the rate of suicide attempts tend to be higher than what it is for the rest of the population. So we see a lot of that, and we see a lot of families in which communication has become difficult or the family roles have been disrupted. Because maybe the kids have been raised here, they speak the language, they might be the ones that are documented, and they are put in a position of power at a young age, so they end up being the interpreters of the family, and putting the parents in a situation in which they're in a disadvantaged position.
So you get that sometimes families where, like Valentina's, there are some people who are documented and some who are undocumented?
Yes, we call them mixed families, families in which some of the members are documented and some of the members are undocumented.
So what does that do to them collectively as a family?
It creates a very difficult situation because some of the family members, they have some advantages that the others don't. It might be the kids are the ones that are documented. They might be in a position that is in an advantage position over their parents. Also, you see a lot when you have siblings, so some of them are documented and some of them are undocumented, that creates tension. I we also see a lot that kids, whenever they get the opportunity of maybe through DACA, that we have been talking about that, they get the opportunity of getting their Social Security through DACA. Many people think that their first instinct is to get and make educational plans, but many times they just want to keep their parents safe. And, you know, especially in the Latino community, the needs, the aspirations of my family are going to go beyond my own personal ones. So probably instead of planning on going to school, I'm going to go get a driver's license and keep my mom safe so she doesn't have to drive, or making sure that dad can go, you know, to and from work. So that he doesn't have to be at risk of being stopped by the police and potentially getting deported. So it's a very complicated family dynamics that creates a lot of uncertainty.
So the children, in effect, become caregivers for their parents.
That is true. They become caregivers and they become responsible for their families.
I wonder also if the fact that DACA recipients, they would be born in the United States, they haven't gone through the experience of emigrating for whatever reason. What are some of the stressors that actually drive people here?
Many people don't realize. They think, it's so difficult here if you're undocumented, but you don't realize how difficult it's there. I always say, our organization does a lot of cultural competency work, and I always tell people that I've been blessed enough that I have never made a decision in my life out of hunger and desperation. You know, my family is from Puerto Rico. We were born American citizens. So we came here out of convenience. This is our home now. But we don't know, when you are desperate, when you are that mom that is unable to feed your children, you know, day in and day out, then when they tell you that if you come to Atlanta, Georgia, By cleaning a house, you're going to make in a day what you make in your country in a month. You are going to make that trip because it's an opportunity. You have a child that might have a special need or an illness that requires special care, and there's a possibility here for them. Just put yourself in those shoes as a parent. Would you make the trip? Probably you would, because, you know, as a parent, your instinct is to protect your children and to try to give them everything they need.
So when somebody finds themselves here suffering from, as you said, anxiety or depression, what are some of the barriers that keep them from seeking help?
Especially for Latinos, the main barrier is that there are barely no services for them. If you think Georgia has a law that creates what is called community service boards. These are entities that were created by the state government to be in charge of the mental health in every county. None of the community services board have continuous, consistent services in Spanish. The domestic violence safe houses, they don't have consistent mental health services in Spanish. So the access, the lack of services, the lack of availability of those services is the first barrier. And maybe there's also a stigma, because in the Latino community, seeking mental health help seems like, you know, like a little bit of a taboo. I'm not crazy. I don't need those services. So you have to create accessibility to those services, and also make it an education point of helping Latinos understand that once the services are available, you have to take advantage of them.
Belisa Urbina is my guest. She's executive director of Ser Familia. She's executive director of Ser Familia. That's a counseling organization for Hispanic and Latino immigrants in the Atlanta area. Given the number of Latino immigrants proportionately to other immigrant populations, you think that they are less well served?
Yes, certainly they are, because not only we have more Latinos that any other immigrant community, this community is growing, you know, at a faster rate. According to the Atlanta Regional Commission, almost one in four residents in the Atlanta metro area is going to be Latino by 2040. So the community keeps growing by leaps and bounds. And now a lot of that growth comes from these second and third generations. But these kids, even though they might speak English, you know, for them, Spanish is the language of their heart. Their feelings, their dreams, they are in their native language. And also, they are very attached to those cultural values, because the kids, even though they speak the language, you know, they are going to be attached to the values of their parents. In our youth group, we have a lot of kids that are second generation. We have a lot of DACA recipients that are volunteers of our youth group. And, you know, they speak English perfectly, but whenever they are stressed out or they're very sad, they start speaking Spanish. It becomes natural. And more interesting, they speak Spanish with the accent of a country that they have never visited. It's the accent of their parents.
That is fascinating, that they sort of revert to something that it's like they're picking up their parents' distress. And I'm wondering about that. It's one thing that if you're growing up in this country and feeling depression or anxiety, but living through your parents' carried experience, how does that affect the whole family?
It affects the whole family in the sense that many times they feel they cannot move forward. For me, one of the things that really makes me very sad is when I see these young people that were either born here or were moved, or they moved to Georgia at a very young age. This is their home. They are from Georgia. They consider themselves to be from Georgia. But they feel like they are not welcome here, that they don't belong, that they don't want you here. Many of them also see and feel the rejection towards their parents and their parents' culture. And that creates a sense of despair. You know, they don't want us here. I don't belong here. Nonetheless, this is my home. So it is a very complicated situation, and it creates a lot of tension and a lot of sadness in those families.
Belisa Urbina is executive director of Ser Familia. That's a counseling organization for Hispanic and Latino immigrants in the Atlanta area. Just ahead, what happens when a writer of young adult fiction takes on the immigrant experience? But first, we're going to continue my conversation with Belisa Urbina. She's executive director of Sur Familia. This is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Ooh, child, things are going to get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Ooh, child, things are going to get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Someday, yeah, we'll put it together and we'll get it undone.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. All this hour, we're talking about the immigrant experience, especially the mental health of immigrants and undocumented people. And we would like to hear from you. Are you a first-generation immigrant? And have you experienced anxiety or depression? You can call us and share your story at 404-500-9457 or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Before the break, we were talking about the mental and emotional challenges facing immigrant communities, and I want to return to our conversation with Belisa Urbina. She's executive director of Sur Familia. It's a counseling organization for Hispanic and Latino immigrants in the Atlanta area. I asked Belisa what happens when that distress of being undocumented puts somebody at risk for a mental health disorder.
Everybody has days in which you feel sad or you feel a little bit of despair, but once it becomes chronic, you know, in other terms, maladaptive, it becomes a problem that it gets reflected in a lot of family violence. You see a lot of discord among the partners, mom and dad. You see a lot of, you know, bickering and arguing and distrust among the parents and the kids. Oh, now you are rejecting my culture, you're assimilating into the American culture, you don't love us anymore. The kids feel trapped. You know, I am not Latino enough for my parents. I am not American enough for the peers at school. So I don't belong. And then you see the kids, you know, sliding into chronic depression and chronic anxiety. And you see it in the statistics that are collected. Latinos in Georgia, Latino young people in Georgia have higher rates of anxiety and depression than almost anybody else in the United States.
Historically, people experiencing that kind of those kind of symptoms self-medicate with drugs and alcohol. Is that happening more in the Latino or the immigrant population than the general population?
To be honest, I have not seen, any statistics, because sadly there are not enough, you know, data collected in Latinos, among Latinos. So I have not seen hard numbers that tell us that. I don't see in the everyday experience that we are having more drug addiction problems. What I see for years, Sur Familia, an organization, has been talking about their concern, our concern, for our Latino young people and the behavior problems that they were presenting. Now, we are getting calls from almost every juvenile court in the metro area asking for support because they have seen a spike in the number of Latino kids coming through juvenile court. So I am not qualified to say that we are seeing more drug addiction problems, but we are seeing more behavior problems that are becoming chronic and require the intervention of the juvenile court and DSAC.
We just heard from Valentina Gonzalez some of the reasons why she was hesitant to bring her charges of having been sexually assaulted to her campus police, to her local police. But there are also a number of policies in effect requiring organizations to report undocumented immigrants. Is there any risk for you as an organization or an agency in treating or helping undocumented people?
We have a strong partnership with pro bono attorneys that help our organization. And so far, we have not engaged in any type of behavior or anything that we do is going to put us at risk or put our clients at risk. We're also very careful in the types of funding that we accept for the agency, just to make sure that we can protect our clients, because that is so important. If they are willing to step up, if they are willing to come and seek help, we want to make sure that we are going to protect them. And so far, none of the funding streams or anything that we are doing requires us to disclose information about a person being documented or undocumented. Many of the people that people don't realize that if they are victims of crime and they help in the prosecution or you know, denouncing and prosecuting their attacker, you know, that might open the door for some legal remedies, immigration remedies for them.
But Lisa, it sounds like you and your colleagues are treating not just individuals, but entire family systems on some level. What have you noticed about the mental health of the people you work with? I mean, how does that job affect their own mental health and well-being?
You're talking about our employees, our volunteers?
Yes, I'm talking about people who work with you. And are they all volunteers?
Yes, we have, our organization has more than 200 volunteers. Most of them were past program participants who graduated from the programs, and this is their family now. They want to stay involved. They want to help out. They want to help others. And you are talking about something really important. We call that vicarious trauma. Our employees, our volunteers, they get affected by the stories they hear day in and day out. You know, sometimes you have a case, a really difficult case. You need to look for services for that family, but there are no services out there. You don't know how to refer them. Some of the stories are really heavy, you know, very complicated, very sad. And yes, it affects our employees, and we have started to put in place systems to make sure that we protect our employees, which are very important to make sure that we are able to deliver, you know, the care that the community needs.
Melissa, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting us. It is a pleasure at least to bring these ideas and probably opening the eyes of the hearts of the listeners.
That's Belisa Urbina. She's executive director of Sur Familia, a counseling organization for Latino and Hispanic immigrants. We're talking this hour about the immigrant experience. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, keeps immigrants who arrived in the U.S. as children from being deported. The program's future is still unclear. Our next guest has been working on the front lines in Georgia for immigrant rights and brings her message to young adult fiction. Emory University professor Marie Marquardt spoke with my colleague Adam Ragusea about her latest book, Flight Season.
Flight Season, like all of my novels, is a book that sort of dives into the challenges of living inside a broken immigration system here in the South. It looks at the ways that all of our lives are impacted by this broken system. And also it looks at the ways that people, through loving one another, supporting one another, and just caring deeply about building a future together, can do that, build a future together. So I hope that all of my novels, including Flight Season, is a hopeful one. But it's a tough time to be writing these stories. And Flight Season revolves around a young immigrant from Guatemala who becomes very ill and lands himself in the hospital. And it's a summer of just transformation, building friendships, and building love between people who really don't expect to see that coming into their lives through this summer.
How did you come to approach this topic in your fiction?
Well, for about 20 years now, I've been working in a range of ways around issues of immigration, and in particular undocumented immigration and asylum seekers. I started as an academic doing academic research on these issues and then became more deeply involved in advocacy and also service. I work in particular with detained immigrants and their families. And over the course of that time, I just have really developed some profound friendships that drove me into action and to a deeper understanding and a deeper desire to help others understand what it is, what this time we're living through is, and how it really impacts us all in all of our lives. And so I began to write, first academic writing, and I began to talk a lot to anyone who would listen about what's broken about our immigration system. And I realized that while we can understand with our intellects, and while most Americans do understand with our intellects, what's wrong with this system, I think what we really need in this moment is the capacity to build empathy and shared understanding more than anything. And I think fiction does that beautifully.
As part of your advocacy work, you volunteer with an organization called El Refugio. It's a ministry that helps families and loved ones of detainees. And we spoke with El Refugio's director, Amilcar Valencia, about the people that he helps with your assistance.
These are people who are going through difficult moments of having a father, husband, son, or a friend detained. This woman, her father was deported. Then her husband was detained, and she came again to visit him, and he was deported too. Her brother was also detained and was deported. You know, her father, her husband, and her brother.
So I'm sure, Marie, that in the work that you've done with that organization and others, that you are constantly coming across very, very moving personal stories about real people. Are you modeling characters in the YA fiction books that you write after real people that you work with? I imagine that could be a particularly fraught thing to do. On the other hand, they say write what you know, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So while none of my characters is directly one-to-one connected to a person that I've come to know and care about through my work with El Refugio, everything, in fact, every story that I've written, I realized recently goes through that terrible place, the Stewart Detention Center. Every story that I've written is inspired by my desire to ensure that more people know what's happening there and what's happening in our communities and in our society. I also want to say it was beautiful to hear Amilcar's voice. Being a part of El Refugio has been really one of the most important things to happen in my life. And one of the things that I've learned from El Refugio that really comes through in this novel, Flight Season, more than in the others, is that sometimes what's required of us is to walk with people, to accompany them through their grief and their suffering, and to refuse to turn away from it. And I've really learned that not only from my colleagues at El Refugio, but also from all the people that we've served and developed friendships with and relationships. So Flight Season is really a story about how to face grief head on, not to fear it, but to stay with it and to stay present to it.
We're speaking with Emory University Professor Marie Marcourt. Her latest book is Flight Season. She writes young adult fiction novels that are deal with the issue of immigration. What do you think fiction can do to illuminate this issue for people that wouldn't better be done by journalism, for example?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I have come to believe, again, through my own experience and talking with many, many people about these issues, that what we need to build in order to move forward on finding a solution for something like what our current DACA recipients are facing, about 24,000 here in Georgia, is, again, not only to have a sense that it needs to change with our minds, but also to have a sense that we all are connected deeply, emotionally, and through the heart to DACA recipients in our community. And I've found that one of the best ways to do that is by telling stories. And I do tell stories in my nonfiction writing as well, but in some ways, fiction frees us to tell more profound truths. And for me, it's been really remarkable to be able to spend time sharing stories in a new and really, in a sense, more truthful and honest way through fiction.
Let's hear some more voices of people directly affected by this issue. If DACA goes away, a lot of folks in Georgia could be affected. Jesus Guzman is one of them. He arrived in the U.S. illegally as a child. He now calls Chatsworth, Georgia, his home. He's able to stay here because of the federal DACA program that provides at least temporary amnesty to many children who arrived in the U.S. illegally. Guzman says many people that he knows in the area have been deported nonetheless.
I go to church. In our church, I had met many people that now they not here because they've been deported. That made me feel so sad because many of my friends, now they don't have either their mom or daddy with them. I was afraid that can happen to me too, or my family.
And let's also hear the voice of Carlos Chavez, who works at a restaurant at Plaza Fiesta. He's the owner of a restaurant there. It's called, that's a large shopping center in Chamblee, by the way, just outside Atlanta, and caters to the Latino community. Carlos came to the U.S. from Mexico City and has called Atlanta home for the last 35 years. He says that that shopping center, Plaza Fiesta, has been a safe haven for immigrants.
Atlanta is still very divided. South side, Afro-Americans, north side, more white Americans. So we are in the middle. We are like fighting between both of them, and we blend it in. Some people like us, some people don't. So it all depends on what day they get up on the right side of the bed, you know.
So Professor Marquardt, for people who are not directly in terms of their own person or their family, people who are not directly impacted by problems in America's immigration system, for people who are not directly touched by what we're talking about, what's the one thing that you think they need to know?
Well, first, I would urge them to pause for a moment, look around, pay close attention, and recognize that all of us are directly impacted by this broken immigration system. Second, I would really like to say in response to those two clips that the young adults who have DACA are extraordinary people. They're extraordinary not only because some of them are, you know, Harvard Medical School students and extraordinary in that way, but they're extraordinary because they are every single day getting up, getting out of bed, working hard to build a future that they know could be pulled out from under them at any moment. They are a model, an example for all of us about how to move forward in these very difficult times. So I want to make sure that we hold them up as extraordinary in those everyday ways, and see them as a part of our community, as embedded in our community, and not somehow as victims set apart.
Emory University Professor Marie Marquardt spoke with my colleague Adam Ragusa. Her latest novel is Flight Season. That's our show for today. We spent the hour talking about the immigrant experience, in particular, how that experience affects mental health. And we want to hear from you about your experience coming to the U.S., and if you're a first-generation American, how has your family's experience affected your mental health or the mental health of your parents? Give us a call at 404-500-9457, or you can post your story on Twitter or on Facebook. We're at OST Talk. On Second Thought is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Virginia Prescott.